Welcome to the Reality Revolution. I'm your host, Brian Scott. Today, we have a very different and unusual episode. I'm so excited to read from a book called The Secret of the Saucers by Orfeo M. Angelucci. This is one of the best contactee accounts of the 1950s. Mr. Angelucci's Secret of the Saucers is a memoir of a more innocent time. In a tale of spiritual growth. It was edited by Ray Palmer, the gray eminence behind Fate magazine, the publisher of the first flying saucer accounts and the Shaver mythos, which we will explore in I Remember Lemuria, which is a completely different discussion related to the Emerald Tablets and its actual original writer. In fact, Angelucci's name doesn't appear on the title page, simply Palmer as editor. Angelucci is strangely only listed as a copyright holder. The well-named Orfeo, see Orpheus and his journeys into the underworld, was like Shaver, a regular guy, swing shift line worker at a Lockheed factory in Southern California. On Friday, May 23rd, 1952, by this account, he was strangely drawn to a remote location in Griffith Park, actually not a bad place to land a UFO in Los Angeles. He was contacted by an alien entity named Neptune. Later, he is taken aboard a spaceship, gets to visit their paradisiacal home planet by exchanging bodies with Neptune, meets Jesus, and gets to see the end of the world in 1986, which is why this information is so interesting, because it is wrong on many levels. Angelucci does some seminal UFO myth building here. There was a being named Lucifer who lived on a planet between Mars and Jupiter called Maldek. And this may be one of the origins of the Maldek story that we hear about in Law of One. His hubris led to the planet being shattered into the asteroid belt. Humans were imprisoned on Earth to work off the karmic debt. There is a prime directive which prevents the UFO builders from interfering in Earth's affairs. However, humanity's spiritual evolution is helped along by extraterrestrial godlike entities such as Jesus. The contactee is instructed to spread the UFO builder's message to the world at large, and only a handful are picked from the multitudes. All of these themes have become incorporated in one form or another into various UFO belief systems. If you do get the book, there's a field guide at the end with some fascinating details. UFOs are grown as single large crystal with all of the subsystems intact, and work on some kind of magnetic principle, which is discussed in the Law of One when he starts talking about the crystal balls. We know where he got that information. And they have capabilities such as tractor beams and cloaking devices and inertial dampening. The concepts were very, very fresh and new in the 50s when this was published in 1955. And many of these things didn't even have names yet. This may be the origin of some of these names. They're small drones used for surveillance and huge motherships. For our purposes in understanding the origins of the Law of One material and further exploring telepathic and UFO contact, which is somewhat related to the Reality Revolution conversation as we discuss things like the Law of One and the information from where it comes from and talk about star seeds and that kind of thing. This information is super fascinating. And so I'm not saying it's entirely true. It may not be at all, but it's super interesting to read, and I thought you might enjoy it. I will read the beginning of the book, and if you guys want me to explore this further, I'm happy to. It's just so different for what we do on the podcast. From The Secret of the Saucers by Orfeo M. Angelucci. Chapter 1. The Disc from Another World. Friday, May 23rd, 1952 was an ordinary day in Burbank, California, insofar as I was concerned. I got up at my usual time, worked around the yard for a few hours, and later stopped in at the drive-in snack bar. After several cups of coffee and an exchange of good-natured banter with some of the customers, I left and went to my job at the Lockheed Aircraft Corporation plant. Things went along well enough during the earlier part of the evening, but about 11 o'clock, I began to feel ill. An odd prickling sensation was running through my hands and arms up into the back of my neck. I had a slight heart palpitation and my nerves were on edge. I felt just as I always do before a bad electrical storm. As the familiar symptoms increased, I went outside expecting to find heavy threatening clouds, but the night was exceptionally clear and the stars were bright. Puzzled, I went to work wondering what was wrong with me. By 12:30 a.m., when the quitting whistle sounded, I was so exhausted I could scarcely stand. It would be a relief to get home and into bed. I took my car from the Lockheed parking lot and headed southeast on Victory Boulevard toward home. I became increasingly conscious of nervous tension. As I drove, I sensed a force of some kind about me. Never in all my similar illnesses had I experienced such peculiar symptoms. There was no pain. Yet I felt as though I might die at any moment. The prickling sensation had increased and spread to my arms, legs, and up into my scalp. Frightened, I wondered if an old illness was returning upon me. Was I going to be confined in my bed again with the terrible debility and excruciating pain of constitutional inadequacy of my schoolboy days? Dread symptoms were certainly there. At Alameda Boulevard, I stopped for a traffic signal, and it was then that I noticed that my eyesight was glazed and the sounds of traffic were oddly muffled and far away, as though my hearing was also affected. I decided that I better stop at one of the all-night cafes and have a cup of coffee. But at the thought of all my alarming symptoms increased, I forgot the idea of a cup of coffee. My sole and overwhelming desire was to get home as fast as I could. I continued on Victory Boulevard toward home. I had the illusion that the night was growing brighter, as though enveloped in a soft golden haze. Directly ahead and slightly above my line of vision, I saw a faintly red glowing oval-shaped object. At first, it was so dim I had to stare at it to be certain it was really there. Gradually it increased in brilliance. It was about 5 times as large as the red portion of a traffic light. Nervously, I rubbed my eyes. Something was wrong with my vision, but the thing remained there, not sharp and clearly defined, but fuzzily luminous. Definitely oval-shaped and deep red in color. I continued on Riverside Drive, directly toward the object, but it appeared to be receding from me so that I remained relatively the same distance from it. As it was almost 1 o'clock in the morning, there was little traffic on the road. Apparently no one else had noticed the object, as I saw no car stop to investigate. I wondered if I also would have missed it above the glare of the headlights if my strange symptoms had not drawn my eyes to it. I drove across the bridge over the Los Angeles River with the object still in view. Just the other side of the bridge, to the right of the highway, is a lonely, deserted stretch of road called Forest Lawn Drive. The object stopped and hovered over the intersection. As I drew near, it gained in brilliance, and its red color grew deeper and more glowing. Simultaneously, the physical symptoms I was experiencing became more acute. I was aware of a tingling sensation of pain and numbness in my arms and legs that reminded me of contact with an electrical current. Now the disc veered sharply to the right of the highway and began moving slowly along Forest Lawn Drive. For the first time, it occurred to me that the fantastic thing could be one of those flying saucers I had read about. I turned my car onto Forest Lawn Drive and followed the object. About a mile further along, the disc swerved to the right, away from the road, and hung motionless over an unfenced field some distance below the road level. I drove off the pavement about 30 feet to the edge of the declivity. From there, the glowing red disc was directly in front of me and only a short distance away. As I watched in bewilderment, it pulsated violently, then shot off into the sky at a 30 or 40 degree angle and at very great speed. High in the sky to the west, it decelerated abruptly, hung for a moment, then accelerated and disappeared like a meteor. But just before the glowing red orb vanished, 2 smaller objects came from it. These objects were definitely circular in shape and of a soft fluorescent green color. They streaked down directly in front of my car and hovered only a few feet away. I judged each to be about 3 feet in diameter, hanging silently in the air like iridescent bubbles. Their green light fluctuated rhythmically in intensity. Then, apparently coming from between those 2 eerie balls of green fire, I heard a masculine voice in strong, well-modulated tones and speaking perfect English. Because of the nervous tension I was under at the moment, amounting almost to a state of shock, it is impossible for me to give a verbatim account of the conversation which followed. The invisible speaker obviously was endeavoring to choose words and phrases which I could understand, but there were several things which even now are not clear to me. I can only make a poor approximation of the gist of the words. I do, however, remember the first words spoken, which were, "Don't be afraid, Orfeo. We are friends." Then the voice requested that I get out of my car and come out here. Mechanically, I pushed open the car door and got out. I didn't feel fear, but I was so weak and shaky that I could scarcely stand. I leaned against the front fender of my car and looked at the twin pulsating circular objects hovering a short distance in front of me. The glowing discs created a soft illumination, but I could see no person anywhere. I remembered vaguely that the voice spoke again, calling me by my full name in words of greeting. It further stated that the small green discs were instruments of transmission and reception comparable to nothing developed on Earth. Then the voice added that through the discs I was in direct communication with friends from another world. There was a pause, and I dimly remember thinking that I should say something, but I was stunned into utter silence. I could only stare in fascination at those fantastic balls of green fire and wonder if I had lost my mind. When the voice spoke again, I heard these startling words. "Do you remember your 18 balloons and the mold cultures that you lost in the skies back in New Jersey, Orfeo?" I was astounded to hear the strange voice recalling an incident out of the past which had happened so long ago that I had almost forgotten it. "Yes, yes, sir, I do. Do you remember the strange wingless craft that appeared to be observing your activities?" Suddenly, the entire scene came back to me, crystal clear in my memory. I remember Mabel, my wife, my father-in-law, and our friend and neighbors with me as we stared at that strange disc-shaped object in the sky. I recalled how the object had appeared to follow the balloons bearing my precious cultures of Aspergillus clavatus mold. I had been quite an experimenter in those days. It was then it dawned upon me that the fluorescent discs were similar in shape and behaved in the same erratic manner as had their mysterious craft back in New Jersey. The only difference was that I had seen the craft in daylight when it glistened like metal, whereas the discs glowed in the darkness. "Do you remember us, Orfeo?" the golden voice stated. "We were observing your efforts that day as we have watched you since then." All traces of fear left me at these words, but I could not help but wonder what it all meant. Suddenly I realized that I was feeling very thirsty. As though in response to my thought, the voice said, "Drink from the crystal cup you will find on the fender of your car, Orfeo." Astonished at his words, I glanced down and saw a kind of goblet on the car fender. It glistened in the soft light. Hesitantly, I lifted it to my lips and tasted the drink. It was the most delicious beverage I had ever tasted. I drained the cup. Even as I was drinking, a feeling of strength and well-being swept over me, and all my unpleasant symptoms vanished. "Oh, thank you, sir," I said as I placed the empty cup on the fender of my car to see it disappear. At that moment, another incredible phenomenon began to occur. The twin discs were spaced about 3 feet apart, now that the area between them began to glow with a soft green light, which gradually formed into a luminous three-dimensional screen as the discs themselves faded perceptibly. Within the luminous screen, there appeared images of the heads and shoulders of two persons as though in a cinema close-up. One was the image of a man and the other of a woman. I say man and woman only because their outlines and features were generally similar to men and women. But those two figures struck me as being the ultimate of perfection. There was an impressive nobility about them. Their eyes were larger and much more expressive, and they emanated a seeming radiance that filled me with wonder. Even more confusing was the troubling thought somewhere in the back of my mind. They were oddly familiar. Strangely enough, the projected images of the two beings appeared to be observing me, for they looked directly at me and smiled when their eyes looked about, as though taking in the entire scene. I had the uncomfortable feeling as they studied me. They knew me and my every thought in my mind, everything I'd ever done, and vast amount about me that I didn't even know about myself. Intuitively, I sensed that I stood in a kind of spiritual nakedness before them, as I seemed to be in telepathic communication with them for thoughts, understandings, and new comprehensions that would have required hours of conversation to transmit flashed through my consciousness. for these two incredible beings, I felt I was only a shadow of the shining reality I sensed them to be. It is difficult to express my feelings in words, for my understandings of them was gained primarily through intuitive perception. After several moments, the two figures faded and the luminous screen vanished. Again, the two discs flamed in brilliant green fire. Trembling violently from weakness and cold perspiration, I was on the point of blacking out when I heard the voice again. It was more kindly than ever, as it said something about my being understandably confused, but it assured me I would understand everything that had happened later on. Also, I remember these words, "The road will open, Orfeo." I didn't understand. Instead, the thought flashed through my mind. Why have they contacted me, a humble aircraft worker, a nobody? The voice replied, "We see the individuals of Earth as each one really is, Orfeo, not as perceived by the limited senses of man. The people of your planet have been under observation for centuries, but have only recently been resurveyed. Every point of progress in your society is registered with us. We know you as you do not know yourselves. Every man, woman, and child is recorded in vital statistics by means of our recording crystal discs. Each of you is infinitely more important to us than to your fellow Earthlings, because you are not aware of the true mysteries of your being. From among you, we singled out three individuals who is, from the standpoint of our higher vibrational perception, are best fitted for establishing contact. All three are simple, humble, and presently unknown persons. Of the other two, one is living in Rome and the other in India. But for our first contact with the people of Earth, Orfeo, we have chosen you. We feel a deep sense of brotherhood toward Earth's inhabitants because of an ancient kinship of our planet with Earth. In you, we can look far back in time and recreate certain aspects of our former world with deep compassion and understanding. We have watched your world going through its growing pains. We ask that you look upon us simply as older brothers." The voice continued speaking rather rapidly. It stated that they were well aware that the flying saucers had been treated humorously by most people, as it was meant they should be. In this way, they wanted the people of Earth to become only gradually aware of them and grow accustomed to the idea of space visitors. It was best that we receive them lightly at first for the sake of our own stability. The voice stated that the discs were powered and controlled by tapping into universal magnetic forces. Thus, their activated molecules received and converted energy inherent in all the universe. It further explained that the complexities of the apparently simple structure of their discs were so great that to an Earthling, a saucer would be considered as having synthetic brains, although each one is to a degree under the remote control of a mothership. Also, most of the saucers, as well as the spacecraft of other planetary evolutions, are of a circular shape and vary in size from a few inches to hundreds of feet in diameter. A disc, the voice continued, is able only to relay whatever is transmitted to it from a mothership, but also it records precisely all visual, auditory, and telepathic impressions that come within the scope of the disc. These impressions are relayed to the mothership, where they are permanently recorded upon what Earthlings would popularly term synthetic crystal brains. Thus, for centuries had been recorded a detailed account of Earth's civilization and the spiritual evolution of individual persons. The voice also stated that in addition to the remotely controlled saucers, there also existed spaceships, some of which had been seen by Earthlings. It was further explained that the etheric entities in reality had no need of spacecraft of any type, and they were employed by them. It was only for purpose of material manifestation to men. I distinctly remember the voice making some such statement as this: "Interplanetary ships and saucers of various material densities can approximate the speed of light. This seems impossible to you only because of a natural principle, which has not yet been discovered by your scientists. Also, the speed of light is the speed of truth. This statement is presently unintelligible to Earth's peoples, but is a basic cosmic axiom. Approaching the speed of light, the time dimension, as known upon Earth, becomes non-existent. Hence, in this comparatively new dimension, there are incredibly rapid means of space travel which are beyond man's comprehension. Also, within the records of light are to be found a complete history of Earth and every entity which has ever incarnated upon it. Many of the saucers of highly attenuated densities of matter were invisible to earthly eyes and could only be detected by radar. Also, any of the saucers could be rendered invisible at any time or could be disintegrated by either explosion or implosion. Thus, Earthlings had seen some apparently burst in blue or white flash, while others seem simply to vanish in the air. I remember wondering about Captain Mantle and several others who believed they had contacted the saucers. In reply to my thought, I heard these words. Captain Mantle was not pursuing the planet Venus. He was endeavoring to overtake and capture one of the remotely controlled disks. His death was absolutely unavoidable. We wish to tell Earth's people that visitors from other planets occasionally visit Earth's dense, heavy, gaseous atmosphere. All are of kindly intent and none will harm man. All intelligences capable of space travel can read thoughts and see emotions. Man believes himself civilized, but often his thoughts are barbaric and his emotions lethal. We do not say this as criticism, but state it only as fact. Thus, it is best to approach all planetary visitors with friendly, welcoming thoughts. As I listened to his words, I wondered why these incredible beings hadn't landed several spaceships at one of our large airports and thus convinced the world simply and quickly of their reality. In answer, I heard these words. That would be the way of the entities of your Earth, Orfeo, but it is not our way, primarily because we function in dimensions unknown to man and hence interpret all things differently. Also because there are planetary and cosmic laws as implacable as the natural laws of Earth. Cosmic law actively prevents one planet from interfering with the evolution of any other planet. In other words, Orfeo, Earth must work out its own destiny. We will do everything in our power to aid the people of Earth. We were definitely and greatly limited by cosmic law. It is because the life evolution in its present stage of material advancement upon Earth is endangered that we have made our reappearance in the atmosphere of your planet. The danger is far greater than Earth's people realize. The enemy prepares in vast numbers and in secret. For a moment, the voice was still, and then it said gently, "Among the countless other worlds in the cosmos, Orfeo, the children of Earth are as babes, although many of them believe they are close to the ultimate of knowledge. Among the worlds of the universe are many types of spiritual and physical evolutions. Each form of intelligent life adapts itself to the physical conditions prevalent upon its home planet. Most of these evolutions exist in more highly attenuated forms of matter than upon Earth. But the majority are rather similar to man in appearance. There is a definite reason for this being so. In reality, we are Earth's older brothers, and thus we will, and Earth's people, insofar as they, through free will permit us to do so." As I listened to that kind, gentle voice, I began to feel a warm, glowing wave of love enfold me, so powerfully that it seemed as a tangible, soft, golden light. For a wonderful moment, I felt infinitely greater, finer, and stronger than I knew myself to be. It was as though momentarily I had transcended mortality and was somehow related to these superior beings. "We'll contact you again, Orfeo," the voice said. "But for now, friend, it is a good night." The two shimmering green disks faded almost out. Then I heard a low hum as they flamed brilliantly into glowing green fire and shot up into the sky in the direction taken earlier by the larger red disk. In an incredibly short time, they too had vanished, leaving me standing alone by my car. Bewilderment, incredulity, shock, and stark fear flooded over me, sudden conviction that I had lost my mind and gone raving mad. What I had witnessed, I felt, just couldn't have happened. I raised my numbed hand and I was trembling violently. I saw by my watch that it was almost 2 o'clock in the morning. I climbed shakily into my car and kicked the starter. Panic was mounting in me. I twisted the steering wheel, gunned the engine, and made a sharp, fast U-turn to get back onto the road. The tire screamed and the car lurched. I wanted to get home quickly. I wanted to get back to the world of sane reality. I wanted someone to assure me I wasn't going mad. I drove with only a single objective in my mind, to get home. When finally I made the turn onto Glendale Boulevard and saw the lights of my apartment, I breathed a heavy sigh of relief. No place had ever looked so good to me. I left the car in the driveway and ran into the house. My wife was waiting up, worried and anxious because I was so late. Orfeo, what's the matter? What's wrong? You're white as a sheet. I stood staring at her, unable to speak. She came to me and grasped my hand. Orfeo, you're sick. I'm going to call a doctor. I put my arms around her. I wanted only to feel her close to me, and for the moment to try not to think what I had been through. She pleaded with me to tell her what had happened. Tomorrow, maybe tomorrow. Maybe I can tell you. Finally, we go to bed, but it was almost dawn before I drifted into a troubled half-sleep. Chapter 2, I Travel in a Flying Saucer. I spent nearly all day Saturday in bed. The shock of my fantastic experience was so great that I found it difficult to get back to actualities. I kept having the feeling that the world I knew was a phantom world inhabited only by shadows. It was not until Sunday that I could bring myself to tell my wife what had happened to me. I was afraid she would think I had lost my mind. Thus, it was with a relief I heard her say, "If you say it happened like that, Orfeo, I believe you. You've always told me the truth, but this thing is so strange and frightening, and you look so deathly white when you came in." I could only put my arms around her as I replied, "It scares me too, Mabel. I don't know what to think." Sunday afternoon, I took my 12-year-old son, Richard, and drove back to the spot on Forest Lawn Drive where I had seen the discs. There in the loose dirt, I found the deep skid marks the tires of my car had made Friday night. Richard looked at me curiously and asked why I was looking for. I pointed to the skid marks and told him that was the spot where I had seen what could only have been a flying saucer. Richard stared incredulously, "But Dad, I thought you always laughed at people who believed in those things." "You're right, son," I replied. "That was only because I didn't know any better. Friday night I saw three of the saucers from this very spot." Richard's eyes widened in interest. Then he began shooting questions at me so fast I had to ask him to slow down, but I was glad he did not doubt my word. Seeing those skid marks where I had gunned my car in panic to get away from the eerie spot assured me of the reality of my experience. I was convinced that I had been in contact with beings from another world. Monday night, I went back to my swing shift job at Lockheed. It felt good to be back at work again. The friendly banter, laughter, and jokes of my coworkers were just what I needed. Beyond my family, I told no one of that first experience, as I knew I would be ridiculed. In fact, even at home, very little was said about the saucers or my experience, for the subject invariably upset my wife and filled her with such apprehension that even the boys refrained from talking much about it. But when I was alone, I thought long and often about those incredible beings from that other world. The voice had promised, "We'll contact you again, Orfeo." I wondered when they would get in touch with me again and how. Had they meant soon, or would it mean months or even years? These and hundreds of similar questions clamored in my mind. I wondered if I was under constant observation by them. If so, I thought that through telepathy I could signal them to return. One night I went back to that lonely spot on the Forest Lawn Drive and tried to establish telepathic communication, but it was useless. No glowing red disc appeared, only the night and the empty skies that gave me back no answer. Weeks passed and still no further sign from them. Doubts began to trouble me. Time dulled the memory of that night. I began to wonder if my experience had actually been real after all. Then early in July, there began a fresh flood of well-authenticated sightings of saucers in the skies over Southern California. Local newspapers carried banner headlines announcing flying saucers over Los Angeles. Some people were convinced we had interplanetary visitors and looked for mass landings at any moment. Later in the month, additional sensational sightings were reported from many other states. It seemed the skies were filled with the baffling mystery objects that defied all natural laws and behaved more like phantoms than material realities. As I avidly read each new account, I became convinced anew that I knew the secret of the flying saucers. But I longed for more knowledge. I hoped and prayed for another contact with those incredible beings I had seen so briefly that Friday night. July 23, 1952, I didn't go to work. I wasn't feeling well and I believed I was coming down with the flu. I was in bed all day, but in the evening I felt a little better and thought a walk in the fresh air would be good for me. I walked down to the snack bar at Los Feliz Drive-In Theater, several blocks from the 11-unit apartment court where we live. Small Cafe has a warm, friendly atmosphere, and it gave my spirits a big lift to listen to the small talk and friendly ribbing. Because of the many recent newspaper reports, the talk turned to flying saucers. Anne, one of the waitresses, laughing remarked that she couldn't get enough sleep as her husband insisted upon staying up most of the night watching the sky with binoculars trying to get a glimpse of a saucer. This brought on a round of flying saucer jokes and everyone was laughing, including myself. The fact that I could laugh indicates that I had pretty well gotten over the shock of my experience. When I'd finished my coffee, I left the snack bar and started home. It was a little after 10 o'clock. Beyond the theater is a lonely stretch of vacant lots. The place is eerie and forbidding at night, for huge concrete buttresses rise from it supporting the Hyperion Avenue freeway bridge several hundred feet overhead. The bridge casts dense, oblique shadows down below, making it a shadowed no man's land. As I crossed the vacant lots in the deep shadows of the bridge, a peculiar feeling came over me. Instantly, I remembered that sensation tingling in my arms and legs. I looked nervously overhead, but saw nothing. The feeling became more intense, and with it came the dulling of consciousness I had noted on the other occasion. Between me and the bridge, I noticed a misty obstruction. I couldn't make out what it was. It looked like an Eskimo igloo, or the phantom of an igloo. Seemed like a luminous shadow without substance. I stared hard at the object. It was absolutely incredible, like a huge misty soap bubble squatting on the ground, emitting a fizzy, pale glow. The object appeared to be 30 feet high and about equally wide at the base, so it wasn't a sphere. As I watched, it seemed to gain substance and to darken perceptibly on the outside. Then I noticed it had an aperture or entrance, like the door to an igloo, and the inside was brilliantly lighted. I walked toward the thing. I had absolutely no sense of fear, rather a pleasant feeling of well-being. At the entrance, I could see a large circular room inside. Hesitating only an instant, I stepped into the object. I found myself in a circular domed room about 18 feet in diameter. The interior was made of an ethereal mother-of-pearl stuff, iridescent with exquisite colors that gave off light. There was no sign of life, no sound. There was a reclining chair directly across from the entrance. It was made of that same translucent, shimmering substance, a stuff so evanescent that it didn't appear to be material reality as we know it. No voice spoke, but I received the strong impression that I was to sit in the chair. In fact, a force seemed to be impelling me directly toward it. As I sat down, I marveled at the texture of the material. Seated therein, I felt suspended in air, for the substance of the chair molded itself to fit every surface or movement of my body. As I leaned back and relaxed, that feeling of peace and well-being intensified. Then, a movement drew my attention toward the entrance. I saw the walls appeared to be noiselessly moving to close the aperture to the outside. In a few seconds, the door had vanished, with no indication there had ever been an entrance. The closing of that door cut me off entirely from the outside world. For an uncomfortable moment, I felt utterly alone, lost to my family and friends, but almost immediately a pleasant warmth passed over me, giving me once more that feeling of peace and security. I breathed deeply and found the air cool and fresh. Vaguely, I wondered what was going to happen next. Then I thought I heard a humming sound. At first, it was almost inaudible, but it grew to a steady, low-pitched rhythm that was more like a vibration than a hum. Next, I was aware that my body seemed to be sinking more deeply into the soft substance of the chair. I felt as though a gentle force was pushing me against the entire surface of my body. It was a peculiar, pleasant sensation that put me into a kind of semi-dream state. While the humming sound increased, I noticed the room was darkening, as though a heavy shadow was engulfing the room in twilight. As the light diminished, I began to grow apprehensive. I had the realization of how alone and helpless I actually was. For a bad moment, I was on the edge of panic in the tightly sealed, darkening room. When I heard music, it seemed to be coming from the walls. I couldn't believe my ears when I recognized the melody as my favorite song, Fools Rush In. The panic within me subsided, for I realized how safe I was with them, they who knew my every thought, dream, and cherished hope. Reassured, I settled back to enjoy the music. In a few seconds, the interior of the room began to grow light again. Soon it was more brilliantly lighted than ever. It was at that moment that I noticed a glittering piece of metal on the floor of the craft. It was the shape and about the size of a quarter. I reached down and picked it up. It was different from any kind of metal I'd ever seen, for it seemed almost to be alive in my hand. It quivered and began to glow almost like a live coal, yet it remained at the same temperature as my body. Now I noticed that the piece of metal was diminishing in size. It was as though some mysterious kind of sublimation or degeneration was taking place before my eyes. Could it be that contact with my hand was causing the substance to dissipate into the air? I placed it back upon the floor of the craft. There it ceased to quiver and the odd glow was no longer apparent. I leaned back in the chair and noticed my soiled, faded work clothes which I had worn when I went back to the snack bar. The coarse fabric appeared crude and glaringly out of place in the exquisite, shimmering mother-of-pearl room. Where are they taking me? I wondered as I half listened to the music, for I was certain that the craft was in must be moving. They were taking me to their world, or I was going to spend eternity lost in space in that pearly igloo. While I was still pondering these questions, I felt the push against the surface of my body lessen then cease altogether. The music stopped playing and the humming vibration in the floor died away too. I was certain that whatever type of motive power was used was housed somewhere below the floor, as the faint vibratory hum definitely came from there. Then smoothly and noiselessly the chair made a quarter turn toward the wall. Even as much as I trusted my unseen friends, I was a little frightened at this. Tensely, I waited, gripping the arms of the chair. Directly in front of me, a circular opening appeared in the wall about 6 feet in diameter, but everything appeared hazy through it. As I stared, the lights inside darkened. Then either the entire craft or the seat turned slightly more to the left, and the strange window widened about 3 more feet. I saw a huge globe surrounded with a shimmering rainbow. I trembled as I realized I was actually looking upon a planet from somewhere out in space. The planet itself was a deep twilight blue intensity, and the iridescent rainbow surrounding it made it appear like a dream vision. I couldn't see it all, for a portion at the bottom of the sphere was cut off by the floor line. Now I heard that voice I remembered so well. Orfeo, you are looking upon Earth, your home. From here, over 1,000 miles away in space, it appears as the most beautiful planet in the heavens and a haven of peace and tranquility. You and your earthly brothers know the true conditions there. As I listened to the tender, gentle intonations of that wonderful voice, an overwhelming sense of sadness came over me. I felt tears in my eyes. I, who had not known the relief of tears since I was a small boy. My heart was so full of emotion that tears were the only possible expression. They flowed unheeded down my cheeks. I was not ashamed, for the tears seemed somehow to cleanse and purify me and to break the hard, unfeeling, crystallized shell of the reasoner that I had come to pride myself upon being. The voice said softly, "Weep, Orfeo. Let tears blind your eyes, for at this moment we weep with you for Earth and her children. For all of its apparent beauty, Earth is a purgatorial world among the planets evolving intelligent life. Hate, selfishness, and cruelty rise from many parts of it like dark mist." The words brought fresh tears to my eyes as I thought of conditions on Earth and how they must appear to those perfected, compassionate beings who had extra-dimensional sight. There was silence for a moment, then I noticed that the room was apparently revolving away from Earth. Gradually, the heavens came into view, an awesome, breathtaking sight from that tiny craft. All space appeared intensely black, and the stars, incredibly brilliant, set like jewels against black velvet. Large, small, single, and clustered, I felt lost in a strangely beautiful, ethereal world of celestial wonder. All was brooding silence, order, and indescribable beauty. A deep feeling of reverence possessed me. I had never been an actively religious man, but in that moment, I knew God as a tangible, immutable force that reaches to the furthest depths of time and eternity, and I felt assurance that the beings in whose care I was at the moment were close to the infinite power. For a moment, there was deep silence. Then, as I wiped away the tears, I saw a fantastic object coming slowly into view through the window. It resembled a dirigible, except that it was definitely flattened at the bottom. it emerged gradually into view from the right. I studied it closely, wondering at its composition. It did not appear to be metallic like an airplane, but it was definitely crystalline and gave the illusion of transparency. Its light properties definitely suggested perfect crystal alloyed throughout. I surmised it might be some sort of crystal metal plastic combination. When the entire ship was in view, it appeared to be at least 1,000 feet long and about 90 feet thick, but it could have been a great deal larger, for there was no way to judge how close I was to it. I stared fascinated at the half-ethereal ship, scarcely conscious that I was again hearing music. But as my ears caught a startling, unfamiliar strain, I listened intently to music such as I had never heard or could imagine. It is beyond description, for it was not music as we know it, nor was it played to our musical scale. The strange, haunting drifts of melody that brought visions of star galaxies and planets spinning in notes of perfect harmony. The voice spoke again, "Brother of Earth, each entity of your planet is divinely created and immortal. Upon your world, the mortal shadows of these entities are working out their salvation from the plane of darkness. Every person upon Earth and its adjoining planes of manifestation are definitely arrayed upon either the positive side of progression towards good or on the negative side of regression toward a greater evil. We know where you stand, Orfeo, but are you going to be content to drift as you have been?" "No, oh no," I replied impulsively. "I want to work constructively. Only grant me strong physical health and there isn't anything I shan't be able to accomplish." The voice replied gently, "That wish we cannot grant you, Orfeo, as much as we might like to. It is only because your physical body is weakened and your spiritual perceptions thereby keener that we've been able to contact you. Had you been physically in robust health with your mortal body and mind perfectly attuned to the sluggish, lowered vibrations of Earth, we could not have manifested to you. Sickness, ill health, and all mortal afflictions are transient and unreal. They, along with pain, sorrow, suffering, and conflict, make up mankind's lesson in the school of the world where wisdom and spiritual evolution are gained primarily through suffering. An explanation of this terrible enigma will be given to you later, but tonight, as we tell you that you can rise above the inadequacies of your physical body, Orfeo, as may all other Earthlings, remember always that we love you and your brothers of Earth. We will do everything within our power for the children of Earth that they will permit us to do through free will." With these words, the huge ship I was observing began moving upward and toward the left. One large porthole after another opened in rapid succession as the ship ascended until what appeared to be 3 decks were visible and I could catch fleeting glimpses of the interior of the gigantic skyship. The inside appeared to be of the same luminous mother-of-pearl substance as the interior of the craft I was in. But I saw nothing more, no sign of life, no furnishings or equipment such as we on Earth know. As I watched the ship, I realized the voice as well as the ethereal music had actually originated in the great skyship. It came to me when this must be a mothership, and that its beings in it had remote control over the movements of the saucers that skimmed and skipped our atmosphere. It awed me to realize what a high degree of intelligence and what expert hands were behind the saucer phenomena. I felt ashamed of having pleaded for a healthy body who had already been granted so much. As the craft moved further out into space, I noticed what appeared to be a rotor at each end of the ship. I say rotor, but actually the things appeared to be vortices of flame. With my limited knowledge, I judged these incredible disks of fire to be tremendously powerful plants whose terrific energy could be diverted to almost any purpose. The disks I had first seen used as radio transmitters and receivers, then as a huge 3-dimensional television screen on which, through some method of telepathic contact, it was possible to both see and to hear. Now I saw those same disks apparently propelling the vast skyship. It was my guess that such a power plant had shot the very craft I was in 1,000 miles out into space in a mere matter of minutes without any discomfort to me. It was clearly evident that all of the bewildering and insurmountable problems of space travel that baffled our engineers and scientists had been overcome by these people to such an extent. The entire trip into outer space was as simple as a ride in the elevator. I wondered if they had discovered the secret of resisting gravity with its counterforce. If not, then by what other means had they conquered or neutralized gravity? I remembered that Earth scientists believed that a man in a spaceship would be absolutely weightless and apt to float about. I lifted my hand and let it drop to the armchair. It behaved precisely as it would have on Earth. There must be an artificial gravity induced in the floor of the craft. I wondered, too, how they had overcome the menace of lethal cosmic rays, meteors, sky debris, etc. Surely my ship carried no tons of lead shielding scientists declared necessary for adequate protection from cosmic rays. Also, I wondered in what way they had mastered the terrific pressure and temperature changes so that I was never conscious at any time of variations in either. And their motive power was the fantastic secret of those green fireballs. Possibly they were vortices of magnetic power which operated almost silently and with astounding efficiency. What a wonder world their planet must be, I thought as I gazed in awe at the crystalline dream ship passing from my line of vision. Slowly, then in the room turned back toward the left and the Earth appeared once more with its shimmering rainbow halo. Dimly, I could make out the faint outlines of the Western Hemisphere in varying shades of misty blue. Also, I could see faint puffs of light scattered here and there, which I judged to be the larger cities of the North American continent. Two flying saucers darted into view and sped downward toward Earth. Just as abruptly, they decelerated and hung suspended in space as pinpoints of light. As I was wondering about them, I heard the voice that one was over Washington, D.C., the other over Los Angeles. Los Angeles, the word echoed in my consciousness as I gazed at the faint brush of light that was a great sprawling city. I tried to remember that Los Angeles was my home, but it seemed only vaguely familiar, a place remembered somewhere in time. Tonight, Orfeo, the voice continued, you've explored a minute distance into the limitless highways of the universe. Through your own efforts, the road may later be widened for you. Tonight, you, an entity of Earth, have come close to the infinite entities. At the present, you are our emissary, Orfeo, and you must act. Even though people of Earth laugh derisively and mock you as a lunatic, tell them about us. I will, I whispered haltingly, knowing that everything I said was heard by them, even as all my thoughts were known to them. We know you will, Orfeo, the voice replied. Thus tonight a special privilege has been yours. We love the children of Earth, and it is our desire to help them as the hour of the crisis approaches. But only through such harmless ones as you can we work. The aggressive men of Earth want our scientific advancements. For these, they would shoot our crafts from the skies, if they could. But additional scientific knowledge we cannot give to Earth except as we are now doing in a manner perfectly in accord and harmony with cosmic law. Already man's material knowledge has far outstripped the growth of brotherly love and spiritual understanding in his heart. Therein lies the present danger. To add to the destructive phase of man's scientific knowledge is not permitted. We are working now to turn that knowledge to constructive purposes on Earth. Also, we hope to give men a deeper knowledge and understanding of their own true nature and greater awareness of the evolutionary crisis facing them. At present, we are working along the constructive lines of human endeavor, and especially in fields of medicine and healing. Surely you cannot fail to see the tremendous advances which have been made in this direction within the last few years. Even greater discoveries are at hand, including success in the fight against cancer. Thus shall we continue to work with and through men. I listened to the compassionate voice trying to imprint every word of my consciousness, but I have forgotten much, and these words are only a poor attempt to recall all that I heard. The voice continued speaking. We know your mind is filled with questions. One question in particular troubles you, and it concerns the entity the world knows as Jesus Christ. May we set your mind at rest. In allegorical language, Christ is indeed the Son of God. The star that burned over Bethlehem is a cosmic fact. It announced the birth on your planet of an entity not of Earth's evolution. He is Lord of the Flame, an infinite entity of the Sun. Out of compassion for mankind's suffering, he became flesh and blood and entered the hell of ignorance, woe, and evil. As the Sun Spirit who sacrificed himself for the children of woe, he has become a part of the oversoul of mankind, and the world spirit. In this he differs from all other world teachers. Each person upon Earth has a spiritual or unknown self which transcends the material world and consciousness, and dwells eternally out of the time dimensions in spiritual perfection within the unity of the Oversoul. In the illusion of time is written man's choice through free will, whereby he set in motion the cause of error which inevitably resulted in effect, in which mankind entered mortal consciousness of the living death of his present existence. Thus was he separated from his eternal and perfect self. His one purpose upon earth now is to attain reunion with his immortal consciousness. When this is accomplished, he is resurrected from the kingdom of death and becomes his real immortal self, made in the image and likeness of God. Your teacher has told you God is love, and in these simple words may be found the secrets of all the mysteries of earth and the worlds beyond. Tears coursed down my cheeks under the spiritual scrutiny of that great compassionate consciousness. I felt like a crawling worm, unclean, filled with error and sin. Yes, I say sin, but not in the ordinary sense men use that word. Rather, sin as sin really is. And basically, sin is hypocrisy, falsity, the living lie. It is looking at your fellow man with a friendly smile upon your face with treacherous, malicious, or mocking thoughts in your heart. Sin is any and all deviations from absolute truth, perfect love, absolute honesty, and righteous motives. Thus, actual sin has little to do with earthly standards of sin. As these realizations filled my consciousness, I wanted to fling myself down upon the floor and hide my head in shame for humanity. And of all men, I at that moment felt the lowliest, the least worthy to be where I was. I wondered how great beings could love such a one as I or any of mankind. With our bloody wars, our intense hatreds, our cheap, shoddy intolerances, our greed and avarice, and our cruel inhumanity to our fellow men. I hid my head in my hands and wept bitter tears for a creature so full of error and hypocrisy, and yet so puffed up with egotistical pride over our little material knowledge. At that moment, as in a dream, I heard the strains of the Lord's Prayer, played as through by thousands of violins, as I crouched in the chair fresh. Tears poured from my eyes. My heart was filled with humility, contrition, and with gratitude. Gratitude that these great ones had even considered our miserable, selfish existence. Above the exquisite strains of melody, the voice said, "Beloved friend of earth, we baptize you now in the true light of the world's eternal." A blinding white beam flashed from the dome of the craft. Momentarily, I seemed partially to lose consciousness. Everything expanded into a great shimmering white light. I seemed to be projected beyond time and space and was conscious only of light. 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 Orfeo, earth, the past, were as nothing, a dark dream of a moment. And that dream unfolded before my eyes in swift panorama. Every event of my life upon earth was crystal clear to me. And then memory of all my previous lives upon earth returned. In that sublime moment, I knew the mystery of life. Also, I realized with a terrible certainty that we are all, each one of us, trapped in eternity and allotted only one brief awareness at a time. I am dying, I thought. I have been through this death before in other earthly lives. This is death. Only now I am in eternity without beginning and without end. Then slowly everything resolved into radiant light, peace, and indescribable beauty. Free of all falsity of mortality, I drifted in a timeless sea of bliss. At last, as from a vivid dream, I regained consciousness. Dazedly, I looked about the interior of the craft. Everything was the same, but it seemed 10,000 years had passed, and what must have been only a few moments. I was half conscious of a burning sensation on my left side, just below the heart, but I thought nothing of it then. Ethereal drifts of music were in the air, far away. I could feel more than hear a pulsing vibration beneath the floor of the craft. Also, I was again aware of the gentle push of my body against the cushioned chair. I realized I was being taken back to Earth. In an incredibly short time, the wall opened and I saw the familiar surroundings. Yes, I knew I was home again, but I also realized a little sadly that Earth could never again really be my home. In the spiritual evolution of mankind, I had been expendable in this life, thus I had passed through death and attained infinite life. As I got up from the comfortable chair, I reached down and picked up the strange shining bit of metal and carried it in my hand as I left the craft. In a kind of daze, I walked away from the ship, then curiously turned to look at it from the outside once more, but it was gone. I looked up and there it was, high in the sky, faintly visible as a fuzzy, luminous bubble. Then suddenly it was not there at all, but high in the northeastern sky, I saw a red, glowing disc which changed to green and vanished. I glanced down at the round bit of strange metal in my hand. It was glowing and living again, and appeared almost to be alive as it quivered in contact with my flesh. Also, it was rapidly diminishing in size. By the time I had reached home, it had dissipated into nothingness. As I was undressing to go to bed, I remembered again the burning sensation I had felt on my left side while I was undergoing the profound initiation in the saucer. I glanced down and saw what appeared to be a circular burn, about the size of a quarter, on my left side, directly below my heart. The outer rim of the circle was red, inflamed and slightly raised, as also was a small dot in the center of the circle, the symbol of the hydrogen atom. I realized they had impressed that mark upon my body to convince me beyond all doubt of the reality of my experience in the cold light of the coming days. Chapter 3. My meeting with Neptune. Following the emotional shock of that profound and bewildering trip in the saucer, I went about in a veritable daze for weeks. I continued on the job at Lockheed and resumed the routine of my daily affairs, but I was like an automaton, a dweller in two worlds, and at home in neither. It is almost impossible to explain my state of mind, but the great spiritual illumination I had received in the saucer left me something of a stranger to my own planet Earth. I longed to tell the world, to blazon out of the truths of my discoveries, yet I knew that for the greater part I must forever remain silent. Among other glimpses of reality, I attained the realization that time is non-existent. What we call time exists only in this physical world and is an illusion of the senses. Also, I know now that our concept of space is entirely erroneous. But who could I convince of these truths and other truths? Who would believe me? Because they had requested that I tell Earthlings of my experiences. I told many persons about my trip in the flying saucer. Nearly everyone laughed and ridiculed me. I was the butt of numerous jokes. Someone was always wisecracking. Are your saucer pals going to show up tonight, Orfeo? Or tell one of the saucers to land over at the drive-in theater, Angie, and then we'll all believe it. Such remarks invariably brought forth gales of laughter at my expense. But I no longer cared. I knew, and that was enough. As my story got around, several newspapers printed derisive accounts of the saucer man. It cut deeply to see the embarrassment and humiliation it all caused my two sons. They knew people were saying their father was a screwball. They didn't want to go to school because their companions laughed at them. I knew it all hurt. Mabel, too. Mabel pleaded with me to forget my experiences. I tried to explain to her why I had to tell about them, and we had some bitter misunderstandings on the subject. I wanted so much to do something constructive, but I didn't know how to go about it. I began calling various military and defense offices. Personnel of several of the smaller ones laughed openly and passed me off, I know, as a crackpot. But it was with a tremendous relief I found the really important offices referred to me to men who were genuinely interested. They questioned and cross-questioned me concerning the information I gave them. A little later, I began giving weekly talks to small groups of interested people about space visitors. At these first meetings were held in private homes, and then as attendance increased, we met in the Los Feliz clubhouse. In what little spare time I had, I began writing down my experiences and planned to publish them in a small newsbeat, for I believed I could reach more of the people that way. But as the days and weeks passed following my fantastic trip in the saucer and nothing more happened, I began to feel a little uncertain. The constant ridicule and laughter created even more doubts. My insistence upon the absolute truth of my experiences finally appeared to be definitely alienating my friends and even my family. My story was unbelieved upon Earth, and the mysterious visitors were doing nothing to aid me. I began to doubt my own sanity, to wonder if the bizarre experiences had been an illusion or hallucination of some sort. And yet an inner tribunal of truth assured me that such was not the case, for with them I had seen and known reality, and I could never forget that. On the night of August 2nd, I and Mabel were helping out the Los Feliz drive-in theater snack bar. About 11 o'clock, I went outside for a breath of fresh air. Over the hills to the west, I noticed a fuzzy green light apparently hanging, suspended in the sky. I watched it for several moments, then went inside and called Mabel, seven or eight others, to come out and see it. All of them saw the mysterious light hanging motionless in the sky over the hill. Unable to explain it, some of them declared it must be a helicopter hovering in the air. Others thought it might be a street lamp or something like that. When after 3 or 4 minutes, the street lamp climbed slowly and silently into the heavens and suddenly vanished, no one had much to say, but for some perverse reason, none of them wanted to admit that it was actually a flying saucer. As they trooped back into the cafe laughing about Orfeo and his flying saucers, a depressing wave of discouragement passed over me. It was useless, absolutely useless, to talk to anyone about the saucers of my experiences. Feeling greatly disheartened and very much alone, I decided to leave and walk home. As I cut across the vacant lots, the Hyperion Avenue Freeway Bridge loomed huge and dark ahead of me. The night was overcast, and the dense, oblique shadows from the vast concrete structure were heavier and more eerie than usual. Yet in the shadows of the dark archways of the bridge, I had come to feed a kind of warmth and welcome a spiritual communion with a vastly greater and more kindly world. For it was in the shadows of the huge bridge that I had come upon the saucer which had carried me out of this world. I was thinking of these things when I suddenly became aware of someone approaching from out of the darkness. I was startled, for I had never before met anyone taking the shortcut beneath the bridge so late at night. I was about to call out a word of greeting when it dawned upon me the stranger was coming from the dead end of the bridge. My first thought was that someone was lying in wait for me, possibly to rob me. Before I could become alarmed, I heard the stranger call, "Greetings, Orfeo." My heart almost stopped beating, for immediately I recognized the vibrant, beautiful voice of that being who had spoken to me in the saucer. I stopped in my tracks, utterly speechless, and stared at the approaching figure. But then a wave of joy and gratitude flooded over me, and I finally replied falteringly, "Greetings to you." He laughed pleasantly. "I know that in your mind you have given me a name. I, who have remained nameless to you," he said gently. "You may call me by that name, Orfeo. It is as good as any other, and has more inner significance to you than any name I might give you." "Neptune," I spoke the name slowly and reverently, for it was indeed the name I had given to this great and mysterious being. Then I added, "At least you have come to give me strength and faith." It was near enough then for me to see that he was several inches taller than I had, similar in outline to a well-built man, but the shadows were so heavy that I couldn't make out the details of his figure. But just to be in his presence once more was to sense again a tremendous uplifting wave of strength, harmony, joy, and serenity. "Come, Orfeo," he said gently, continuing on past me. "We have many things to discuss tonight." I followed him as he strode ahead of me through these dense shadows. I could hear his solid footsteps upon the graveled path, which convinced me beyond the shadow of a doubt that he was no phantom or illusion. He led me to a better lighted area near the end of the Glendale Boulevard, where it goes up and over the bridge. I was actually trembling in anticipation of my first actual look at this mysterious visitor from another world. When he turned, I saw his face, the same wonderful expressive countenance I had seen on the luminous screen. I again noticed especially his extremely large, dark, and expressive eyes and nobility and beauty of his features, which actually seemed to radiate warmth and kindness. Then I noticed that he was wearing a kind of uniform, bluish in color, perfectly tailored and tightly fitted to the outlines of his body, but it was apparently without seams, buttons, pockets, trimmings, or design of any sort. In fact, it fitted so perfectly that it was almost like a part of his body. As I studied him, I became aware of an astonishing phenomenon. I could see his uniform and figure clearly, but it wavered occasionally as though I were viewing it through rippling water. And the color did not remain solid and uniform, but varied and changed in spots, which reminded me of the imperfectly tuned television set. Only his face and hands remained immobile and stable, as though not partially obscured by a film of rippling water. Headlights from approaching automobiles fell upon us from time to time, and I remember wondering what manner of being my companion appeared to be to those in the passing cars. Did they see him at all? If so, did he appear as solid and substantial as myself? He moved again forward, motioning for me to follow him. Without speaking, he led me down the sharp concrete declivity into the bed of the dry Los Angeles River. There he sat down upon a large stone and motioned for me to do likewise. For a time he was silent, and I was acutely conscious of a tremendous vibrational field about him, tangible emanation of serenity, brotherly love, and ineffable joy. At last he said, "You sense and understand intuitively many things I cannot say directly to you, Orfeo. You have just fully realized that we are not like Earthmen in that we function in dimensions unknown to your world. Earth is a three-dimensional world, and because of this, it is preponderantly false. I may tell you that to entities of a certain other world, Earth is regarded as the accursed planet, the home of the reprobate fallen ones. Others call your Earth the home of sorrows, for Earth's evolution is evolution through pain, sorrow, sin, suffering, and the illusion of physical death. Believe me, all evolutions are not similar to Earth's, despite the present beliefs of your scientists." As I heard these strange words, my mind and heart cried out, "But why must it be so? Why should Earth's people know pain, suffering, and death?" He looked up into the heavens, and in the soft light, I saw deep compassion in his face as he said slowly, "The answer to that question is one of the mysteries of the illusion of time. But I can tell you this, such conditions did not always prevail among entities who now inhabit Earth. Once there was another planet in your solar system, the fairest and most radiant of all the planets. That planet was the original home of Earthlings. In their native home, they knew no pain, sorrow, suffering, sickness, or death. But destroyed their own planet, which today exists only as a sterile and barren ring of asteroids and debris in the solar system. In order that those entities might gain understanding, compassion, and brotherly love, they were born into the animalistic material evolution of a lesser planet Earth. Suffering, sorrow, frustration, and death became their teacher. Their symbol became the man-beast. Each man must work out his own destiny and salvation in the illusion of time, and through repeated births, deaths, each entity slowly and painfully evolved spiritually toward its former glorified state of divinity. Eventually, all the entities of Earth will again attain their lost heritage. They will have learned understanding, compassion, and true love for God and their fellows." I pondered his strange words thoughtfully, thinking as I did so that what he had said explained many apparent mysteries about man and his lot upon Earth. But soon my attention was distracted once more as I saw the figure of Neptune strangely waver again. Suddenly, the question was in my mind. Was he really there in the truest physical sense, or was he an immaterial projection into the physical world from another dimension? Did I see him in his true form and ordinary state of being, or merely a projection approximate of a man's appearance? These strange thoughts frightened me a little and carried me into deep waters. A reassuring smile lighted his face. "Don't be alarmed, Orfeo. The answer to the troublesome question in your mind is both yes and no. On Earth, form, color, individuality, and material aspect of things is all important. In our world, these illusions are practically no importance at all. Suffice to say that for you, I am an approximation of myself as I really am. I can't make it any clearer in three-dimensional terms." I thought about my own troubled fellows of Earth. Impetuously, I asked, "What about Earth now? On the surface, all seems fairly calm, but I know we are only drifting on dangerous and treacherous waters. In their hearts, many people are troubled and afraid. There is the ever-constant fear of the H-bomb and other horribly destructive weapons being developed in the laboratories. Also, there is the creeping menace of communism that is threatening the world and so many other things." When Neptune spoke, his voice was calm and dispassionate. "Communism, Earth's present fundamental enemy, masks beneath its banner the spearhead of the united forces of evil. Along with good, all men have evil in their hearts to a degree, but some are much more evil than others. Communism is necessary evil and now exists upon Earth, as do venomous creatures, famines, blights, tyrannies, cataclysms. All are negative forces which awaken the positive forces of good in man and cause them to act. Thus are they combated, understood, and ultimately their unreality becomes apparent, for evil is always eventually self-destroyed." He paused, and once more I noticed his uniform darkening and lightening in spots, as though it were made of restless pale bluish clouds and particles of moonlight. Then I held my breath as he continued, "Yes, war will come again to your Earth. We are powerless to prevent it. Millions in your land will fight to the end of their cherished ideals and freedom of the human mind, with only a minimum on their side for victory. The hour of travail, which in future history shall be known as the Great Accident, is nearer than any man dreams, and already the clouds of war are on the horizon, dark and ominous, but overhead beams the rainbow, infinite and eternal. Mankind will survive Armageddon and awaken to new and more glorious days of fellowship and honest brotherly love. In the dawning great new age of Earth, all will forget their bitter hurts and build constructively together upon the solid foundation of the brotherhood of man. He stopped in speaking and turned his radiant eyes full upon me. In the half-light, his countenance was truly resplendent. There is not much more I can tell you now, Orfeo. Since the first publicized modern sighting of our disks in the year 1947, thousands upon Earth have come to believe in us. Many have actually seen our disks. Some have seen us clairvoyantly, others have communicated with us clairaudiently. Still others recognize the truth of our existence and greater scope of being through intuitive perception. But as far as official proof of ourselves, for which so many clamor, we cannot offer that official proof of the existence of our disks will come. But for us to attempt to physically contact mankind through any so-called authoritative source would only be useless and possibly disastrous for them. Nearly all three-dimensional beings have no concept of, nor could they possibly understand, extra-dimensional beings. Tonight, in visiting you, I have broken a code, the code of hands-off as regards any interference in the affairs of Earth. Active cosmic law will see the necessary amends made. He looked at me. His strange eyes suddenly saddened for a moment. I had the uncanny feeling that in his greater vision I appeared to him only as a fleeting, insubstantial shadow, utterly without reality as he knew it. In that revealing instant, I knew that we of Earth are as far removed from the nature as Earth is from the sun. After a while, he said, "I would shake your hand in token of our momentous meeting here tonight, but I cannot. I've gone too far already. For my transgression, we must now recede in equal degree from you. The immutable law of cause and effect upon Earth will govern accordingly as a result, but few will believe or even hear your account of our meeting. In the overall picture, your story will in no way change the conditions upon Earth. Neither will any actual earthly event be either hastened or retarded because of our meeting. At most, your story will give only a greater faith and inner conviction to the few. But it is an important few. The ways of God are immutable and apparent only to those who have spiritual discernment. In the illusion of time, all things will be fulfilled in their proper hour." I found I was trembling and my nerves fairly quivering. Whether from sheer emotion or actually from being with the vibratory range of Neptune, I don't know. I longed to thank him and to express the great feeling of gratitude in my heart, but I didn't quite know how. I said, "From the bottom of my heart, I thank you, Neptune. I pledge my very life to you and the beings of your world that greater understanding may come to mankind." "We know that you will not fail us, Orfeo," he replied. "No other contact may be made at this time, but have no further doubts about the reality of your experiences. The road is open now. Walk it as you will. Your failure will be my own, but I smile upon you for the increased numbers who will come to know us in a truer aspect and to believe in us because of you. Strength and encouragement will be given to the millions who will rise courageously to meet the fiery trials ahead. I tell you this, the great accident is very close, and the fury of the next war will break when it is least expected. When men are talking of peace, I cannot say more." With these prophetic words, Neptune extended his hand to me, but recalling his words, I did not grasp it. He smiled and his face actually seemed to radiate light. "Orfeo, my brother," he said, "with genuine affection, for my sake you refuse to break the code. My trust is forever in you, Orfeo. In your simple action, you have cleansed me from my contact with this ground." He paused and then added, "Soon we shall recede from Earth, Orfeo, and yet in reality we shall never be far away. Later we shall return, but not to you, beloved friend. You will understand the meanings of these words later on." When I made no reply, he said, "I'm thirsty, Orfeo. Perhaps you know where we might get a drink of water." "Oh, yes, yes, sir," I answered eagerly. Getting quickly to my feet, I remembered a small nearby store that remained open all night. "Please wait here. I'll be right back." I left him and clambered up the embankment. As I hurried toward the store, I turned and looked back at the Hyperion Bridge beneath the high center arch. I made out the hazy outline of a kind of ghostly igloo, which I immediately recognized as a saucer similar to the one in which I had ridden. At the store, I bought 2 bottles of lemon soda and hastened back. But as I approached, I was disappointed to see that the ghostly saucer was no longer beneath the arch of the bridge. Quickening my pace, I almost ran to the spot where I had left Neptune, but he was no longer there. I wasn't too surprised, for I had a premonition he wouldn't be there when I returned. I tossed the sodas away and sank down upon the ground. The place was appallingly desolate without him. I felt so acutely alone, so helpless and deserted. Like a child left alone in a dark room, and the light is suddenly extinguished. I looked upward, and my eyes hopefully searched the skies. High in the western heavens, I saw a soft, fuzzy green light, which hung for a moment, then shot away and vanished. "Farewell, Neptune," I said softly as I felt my eyes grow moist. "I know now Earth is not ready for a meeting with the beings from your world, but in the dawning of Earth's great new age, that day will come, friend. We have learned the meaning of true brotherly love when we have overcome to a greater degree the evil inherent in our selfish hearts. Then perhaps we will be worthy to meet the infinitely wiser and gentler brothers of your world. In those days, your fellows will visit us openly and joyfully. No longer will Earth be the accursed planet, home of sorrows." That is the first 3 chapters of this absolutely fascinating book, The Secret of Saucers. And I wanted just to read those first 3 because we get a really wonderful description of what it would be like to meet an extra-dimensional being and why we don't see Ra and other beings come to our planet. If we understand the densities, we would not see these beings. They would have to make themselves known to us. As explained in the Law of One Material, they have to ask permission to visit, and when they do, there's always going to be a result. He sort of violates the cosmic law, and it's a perfect law. There will be some feedback from this law, and so we don't see as many of these meetings because the Earth is like a prison planet, at least according to this material. We have an idea of where this information may have come from the beginning, and where this idea of Maldek and the idea that Maldek was destroyed and is a part of the asteroid belt in space. So I really enjoyed the description of the ship. If you read the Law of One material, that is what they describe their ships as. The crystal bell is described when Don Elkins asks about this in particular. If you're somebody like me who's super fascinated by the origins of the Law of One, you can go back to information on the LL Research website where they talk about the histories of LL Research. And in it, they say that Don Elkins had investigated UFO contactees of the 50s, like Orfeo Angelucci, George Adamski, George Van Tressel, George Hunt Williamson, and Dan Fry. And with Dan Fry and another fellow named Walt Rogers, he found channeled messages that had come to these people after they had a UFO experience. A lot of times there's a deeper story behind why people get channeled messages. If you look at the work of Bashar or watch the documentary on Bashar, he had something very similar. A lot of times people are visited, and this is happening a lot more than people think. Check out my interview with Brian Larson of Metaverse, the music that you hear in the background. He had a visitation that was similar. And as they are saying, as we learn also from George Williamson, they have the ability to completely be invisible and not be seen by us. If we are seeing UFOs, they are showing them on purpose. Their meaning is to invoke a certain level of consciousness so that we become aware of them. They don't have to show themselves to us. They're showing themselves to us to awaken some memory within us. And in a lot of cases, people begin to remember their past incarnations, or that they're a wanderer. So check out the episode by George Hunt Williamson called The Wanderers. Very similar. If I haven't posted it yet, then check it out soon. In any case, there's so much that you can take from this, and you can see where the beginnings of many ideas came. It feels authentic. Anytime anybody were to be met by a flying saucer, most people would not be able to see it. With what we understand about technology, why doesn't everybody have a picture on their iPhones? That's because you wouldn't be able to take a picture of fourth density object with your iPhone. So there is very reasonable ideas that which would make it possible for people to see UFOs that other people don't see. That is going to be a truth in this. And so this is an idea, at least, of what it would be like to meet one of these extra-dimensional beings. It's obviously been a very long time since this happened. We're talking about a 70-year period of time since this event happened that's been written about. The thing to remember about extra-dimensional beings is that time is not what it is for us. When they say it's going to happen anytime now, war is going to happen anytime, something is going to happen soon, that could be 100 years for them. That could be 200 years. Their concept of time is different. So oftentimes they're creating sense of urgency when there isn't one. I see that in a lot of different channeling. So when you get that, just remember they're looking at things from a different sort of timeline perspective. There's a lot of other things to take with it. I'm going to definitely be reading the comments to get an idea of what your impressions were. Whenever I read a channeling or information like this, I'm not declaring that there's truth behind this. I'm super fascinated and I want to share, hey, I found this cool book that has some interesting stuff that I wanted to share with you, and I want you to make up your own mind for it. So if any of this doesn't resonate with you, forget about it. It's certainly possible that this is completely poppycock, that he was doing something and he got caught with his wife and his wife said, why are you home late? And then he had this story and it became so important for him to cover up his lie to his wife. That's why he continued to tell it. That is certainly what the skeptic would say. And so you have to ask yourself, it's true or not. You can go into the Akashic and see. In any case, all episodes of The Reality Revolution can be found at therealityrevolution.com. And welcome to The Reality Revolution.